between Australian kitchens and European kitchens and American kitchens, American ones seem a little bit more formal. And when I've read books like The Inside Story of when the opening of Passy and things, the sort of Chef Keller, Chef This, and you look at the sort of English kitchens and things, they'd be a bit more sweary, or the French ones. Have you seen or do you perceive differences in the way kitchens are run? And
but kind of like the attitude, the ambiance, the atmosphere.
Well,
you know, I don't know. I don't really spend a lot of time, although I did live in Paris for a year and a half and spent quite a bit of time in kitchens over there. But I have to say, when I was there, most of them were run pretty respectfully, and I think that's that's the key right there is respect. Here, the only kitchen I've been in is really Tatsuyu's. Well, actually, Neil's and Tatsuyu's, and those were just during the the events, so you don't know what that's like. But you know, certainly, you know, historically, you know, kitchens have been somewhat of an aggressive environment, if you will. And you know, I certainly was raised in that kind of a kitchen many times where things were very aggressive, whether it was a chef or or cooks. And something that I wanted to try to change in our kitchen was just that. You know, we want to try to maintain a sense of respect, a sense of camaraderie, a sense of team.
And
I think that's really the most important thing. Not to say that, you know, things don't get emotional or things don't get heated once in a while. You know, I mean, we are in a kitchen and you know, it's you know, the chef is trying to give something to his guest, and God forbid anything come between him and that guest, whether it be, you know, a chef de partie or a waiter or a captain or anything like that. But, you know, it's really about getting everybody on the same page in the entire restaurant.
Getting
everybody to understand that, you know, the guest is our goal, and we're trying to not only give our guests a great experience, but give us a great experience. Us in the kitchen, us in the dining room, us in the entire restaurant. I think if we can treat each other respectfully and have a really good working relationship with everybody, all parts of the restaurant, then it's one that we feel comfortable in, one that we feel successful in, and ultimately one that we like to participate in. And if we're enjoying that participation in our workplace, then we're going to do a better job.
And your kitchen teams in the French Laundry and Passy, how large would each of those teams be?
They're approximately the same size as you will for each service. Now, you know, Passy is certainly a much larger restaurant. It has a private dining restaurant, has a baking, has a large bakery. So the overall brigade is probably, you know, two and a half times as large. But services, you know, for Passy dining room, for the gastronomic restaurant Passy, there are 10 people in the kitchen per service. At the French Laundry, they're 9. So it's not that much different per service.
It's not that large as either, really.
Well, they're the same size. They're the same size restaurant, you know, if you will. Per se, it's much, much bigger, the square footage, but they have three components to it as well. Per se, we seat 62 people in the main dining room. Then there's a private dining room off to the side that seats another 10. At French Laundry, we serve 62.
And what's driven you to do what you do in terms of taking you right to the top of the game in America? Because you like Tetsuya here or Heston, you know, you've done something that other people didn't do first.
I think it was my mother's insistence on perfection.
Insistence on perfection. You know, it comes from a friend of mine, but he's running the catering corps in the army.
You know, I think we can trace many of the things that the person that we are. You know, our internal mechanisms back to our parents, you know, who probably had the biggest influence, you know, in all of our lives. And you know, my mother was a woman that had a great work ethic, really paid attention to detail, never gave up. You know, and I think that's, you know, was one thing that is persistence, tenacity, and, you know, always striving to do a better job. So I think, you know, certainly that inner core, those inner core values come from. From that, and of course, along the way, we meet many people that influence your life. And I think that, you know, I've been very fortunate to have worked for some really wonderful people, to have wonderful people that have advised me and have been around me and trying to encourage me. And then ultimately, you know, having a great team that I get to work with at the restaurants.
The story may be similar for many people like that, but not everyone's come up with something as iconic as those little cones.
The cornets.
Cornets,
yeah.
I mean, it's like, where's that come from to make it?
It's a good question because, you know, people talk about creativity. You know, we create this, I create that, you know, he created those. I mean, you know, I truly believe there's no such thing as creativity. Pure creativity doesn't really exist. Everything's here. I mean, the world's here. You know, it was given to us by whatever means. So everything around you is here to use. Mm. And I think the biggest thing for anybody is to have a sense of awareness of where they are, you know, where they are in the world, where they are in place. And if you're aware of what's around you in a constant way, then you're open up to inspiration. Mm. And I think that's the key. It's inspiration is the key. It's not creativity, it's inspiration. Mm. So being aware of what's around you so that you can be open to inspiration. And once you recognize that inspiration, is to be able to interpret it as something that's meaningful for you. Mm. You can be inspired by anything. It doesn't have to be something I see in the kitchen or something I read in a book. It could be anything. I could be walking down the street and see something, and all of a sudden it's a flash of inspiration.
Yeah.
And then it's interpreted as something that's meaningful for me. You know, in many cases, it's about food. And then it's evolution. So I think awareness, inspiration, interpretation, and evolution are key components into what we, you know, as human beings call creativity.
So out of all the sort of dishes you see around, and, you know, Joe Robinson's making and that, but the cornet just seems such an iconic, accessible one to any person, however rich or poor.
Well, when you think about it, I mean, it's an ice cream cone.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where the inspiration came from, was right from. I mean, how many times as a young child growing up in America did I really eat an ice cream cone? And it wasn't until 1990, you know, that I was being served an ice cream cone in a time in my life when I was, you know, under the gun to do a dish in my new city in Los Angeles, and a girl gave me the ice cream cone at the ice cream stand, and bang, I saw the cornet. Now it was totally inspiring at that moment, and I interpreted that into, you know, what has become the cornet. But I think inspiration is all around us, and I think that you can be inspired at any moment. People say, what inspires you? Well. You can't say what's going to inspire you tomorrow because you don't know, but you can recount the past and say these are the things that have inspired me before. Walking down the grocery store aisle and seeing a purple box that said pearl tapioca. You know, therein lies the oysters and pearls.
Yes.
I mean, you know, it's just, it's all these different things. So where do pearls come from? Pearls come from oysters. Mm. You know, you start to make these connections. And I think that's how you define who you are, and ultimately define your dishes.
And you've also made a leap, because with these things and the pearls, oysters and pearls and everything, there's that element of whimsy, which you find in a lot of the high-end restaurants, perhaps apart from maybe France, where it's still very, very serious.
Yeah,
is that a new world thing?
Well, I think we want to take seriousness out of it. I mean, you know, as a young cook, you know, as a cook, we're very serious about what we do. Mm. But you know, when you go to dinner, and I don't really care where you're going to dinner, whether it's the finest of the fine restaurants or casual restaurants. I think we're going there for an experience, and for an experience that's comfortable, an experience that you're engaging your friends, your family, your loved ones around a table. It's a very social experience, and it's not up to the chef or to the restaurateur to try to control your emotions and your personality. I think that we have to let you express yourselves in our restaurants in a way that you're having a good time, and if I can make you smile with the first with the first bite of food that you have by giving you a cornet, I mean that's a real icebreaker, and I think that's meaningful. You know, have that sense of whimsy, but still be very serious about.
Mood has so much to do with it going out.
And I know
Neil says that if people have had a bad hair day at home, they're going to go out and probably not enjoy their meal.
Right. You know, if you come to the French Laundry per se, you better like the person you're coming with, because you're going to sit there for 3.5 hours.
Well, you know, but if you turn up and you're feeling a bit grim and you start off with something funny, it breaks the ice.
You hope so. And I mean, you know, we face that so many times with people who are coming to our restaurants. You know, they're either intimidated, you know, they don't know what they're getting into. I mean, you know, there's lots of people that go to restaurants for many different reasons, and we don't know. We want to make sure that we are welcoming them, giving them a true sense of hospitality, a true sense of generosity, and being very gracious in that way.
Yeah, yeah. I'm fascinated by the number of salts you have per se. Mm-hmm. Is it 17 or something?
You know, it could be at any given moment a lot of different salts. I mean, it's all chlorine, sorite.
You know, there's, especially here, there's a trend where you might just go to a restaurant, you have five of each course and things like that. So 17 salts is over the top.
I don't know if we...
Is that a New York thing?
No, I don't know if we serve 17 salts anymore. It's, you know, it's interesting because, you know, when I first discovered... I mean, salt to me, when I first discovered the amazing ability of salt beyond, you know, the traditional seasoning of food, was the contrast of texture. And I was in Gerard Pengo's restaurant. In New York, this is probably 1989, and And I experienced a moment there when it was a pivotal moment in that textural and flavor combination when he served me a piece of sauteed foie gras with gray salt on top of it. And not only was the flavor enhanced, but the texture of that crunch with the salt was something that was magnificent. And then from that point on, the quest for salt, the quest for that enhancement, because when you think about it, it is the one, probably the only primary flavor enhancer that we have besides this acid. Pepper changes flavor. You know, salt enhances flavor. We always talk about salt and pepper together. But they're totally different. They're opposites. Salt enhances flavor. Of course, if you want to bring out and brighten the flavor with salt. Of course, if you taste the salt, other than what I just described, it tends to be a little too salty. Pepper. As soon as you add pepper, you've changed.
Well, they're just different things, aren't they?
Changed it. Yeah. But so many times you see, add seasoning with salt and pepper.
Yeah.
It's like, well, okay.
Yeah.
It's like really enhance your food with salt and flavor with pepper if that's what you like.
Yeah. Yeah, and what you're creating is very sophisticated, amazing food. Sometimes, do you think wine can seem? I mean, I know winemakers put a lot of effort in, but when you you've created your oysters and pearls, it just seems wine can sometimes seem a bit mundane.
Well, I think what we want to do. I mean, I'm a chef, so I'm really focusing on the food, and I think that we talk about teams, and our sommelier team is very important, and it's really up to them. to make recommendations and suggestions based on their experience and their knowledge for wine to enhance the experience of the food. And I think that, a restaurant is not about food, it's not about wine, it's not about service, it's about all of those things combined and so many other small details that really make up that experience for the guest. So when you're trying to increase the experience or enhance the experience, you're looking at all the different details so that each one of us, in our own capacity, has the ability to impact the guest in a profound way.
How important has technology been? I've got your book on Swiss Food Cooking. Obviously, that's very important. How could you have done what you've done without technology?
I don't think any of us can do what we do without technology. I mean, you have this little machine right here.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, in the old days, these were frowned upon.
Right. But technology is very important. And you look at the history of cuisine, and you wonder what it was like when the first mechanical refrigerator was introduced, or the first gas-fired stove was introduced, and these were major breakthroughs in the technology of restaurants. I remember before there was food processors in restaurants, and now today how would you live without a food processor? I think technology continues to impact what we do in a very, very positive way in our entire lives, except maybe email.
And so cooking at home, a frustration is just you don't have that precision, so the precision for the temperature is very important.
It
allowed you to make a big leap.
Well, when you think about cooking, every recipe that you read, everything that you cook is always about time and temperature. I don't care what it is, boiling a green bean, roasting a chicken, baking a cake. It's all about time and temperature. Every recipe you pick up, preheat the oven to this, or heat the saute pan to that, cook it to this temperature for this period of time. So when you can control that, and make it more precise, then of course the accuracy of what you're cooking is going to be much more successful. And I think as chefs, that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to be as accurate as many times as we possibly can. When you talk about sous vide cooking, or you talk about sous vide cooking to me is not necessarily about the vacuum machine. It's more or less about the immersion circulators, which enable us to have exact temperatures for any period of time that we want. And I think therein lies our ability to be more precise when we're cooking something.
And I suppose it's about consistency.
Consistency. And the greatest restaurants in the world are not the ones that do the best food. The ones that do the greatest food most consistently.
Absolutely. When I last year interviewed Ferran, he was talking about. There's a lot of effort that goes into the kind of food that he does and you do as well, and that in countries perhaps such as Australia and smaller ones without the huge populations, it's difficult for many people to do that maybe in the future and in the current financial circumstances. Where do you think the future of high-end food, where it is? For instance, I was recently in Cambodia, the Hotel de la Paix, with a beautiful degustation for $30.
Oh.
And it's sensational food.
Yeah.
It's up there with anything you find anywhere else. But you know, where is the future? I wonder.
Well, I think the future is always you know, always where it has been in the past. I mean, people are going to continue to seek out, you know, quality food and have that experience of fine dining, whether it's, you know, a celebration of whatever, a celebration of life.
I'm just wondering,
and
the next Thomas Keller to have the resources to do that might, instead of being in France or Spain or London or the Napa Valley, might be in China or Cambodia.
I mean, there. You know, I've learned that there's great food throughout the world, and great chefs throughout the world, and many great chefs who've never been recognized and maybe never be recognized. Mm. I think that, you know, there is a certain amount of luck, you know, that comes in with who we are. You know, whether it's Justin, Thomas Keller, Ferran Adrien, you know, Pierre Gagné. I mean, you know, we work really hard. I mean, let's face it. But there are countless chefs out there that are working really hard. We do a really good job. We have good teams. We have good technology. We have good kitchens. But there are countless chefs out there that have the same thing.
Mm.
What makes one person better than the next? It's a question I really can't answer. I think that there certainly is a bit of luck in there, you know, that really helps. Someone told me a long time ago, you know, you work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and with a little bit of luck, you'll be successful. You know, the point is cast your net, you know, as wide as you can and continue to be focused, and hopefully you'll get recognized one day. It's not that I feel that I'm any better than any other chefs that are out there. In fact, many times, you know, you feel like, you know, you're somewhat diminished because of the notoriety that you have gained. Sometimes it extracts you from the focus of what your intent is.
Yeah.
You think about, you know, as a cook, why did I become a cook? I became a cook because I really like to cook. And have the gratification and satisfaction of doing that and nurturing people every day. Of course, the better you become at any profession, the further you're detached from the actual reason that you got involved in the first place.
Was to
cook. So I don't get to cook as much as I used to, and for me, it's a sad thing.
Yeah.
Nonetheless, my responsibilities have shifted enormously, so that now I have to look at things a little differently and say, how can I have an impact? How can I have an impact on my team and my restaurant that's going to have an impact on my guests? And furthermore, how can I have an impact on the industry? How can I set examples for other young cooks, other young culinarians, and, you know, the you know, the people in general, so they can see a direction to go, follow a roadmap, and do a better job than I've done. I see so many of our team and my team that, you know, I'm so proud of, because I can see that they are already at their age further along than I was at that age, and I, you know, and I'm really proud of that, because I'm giving them the environment, the opportunity to excel, and I think that's really, really where I can be impactful today, as I was 20 years ago, sauteing a piece of fish.
Mm. And are you more of a businessman now than a chef?
I think chefs were many. I refer to the term as modern chef, and I think that, you know, the modern chef is so much different than the last generation of chefs, because we wear so many different hats, if you will. You know, if we want to make that parallel, that analogy to the different hats that we wear. Yeah, we wear business hats. We wear star hats. We wear chef's
hats.
Not
as many business hats as some chefs, though.
Well, I mean, you know, we wear author's hats. I mean, you know, we wear all. You know, we have all the. You know, we wear designer's hats. I mean, we do all these different things today that chefs did not do in the past.
Mm.
So, and there's no, there wasn't really a roadmap for us to follow. We're trying to find what it is that we can do and do well and have an impact, and again try to set the example for the next generations of chefs, and say, okay, I can see where,
well,
I can
suppose you like it can be likened to, say, a creative director. Maybe you
could be
directing,
yeah.
And because do you actually ever get into the kitchen anymore?
I'm in the kitchen every day when I'm when I'm home.
Yeah.
Am I cooking every day? No, but I'm in the kitchen. I want to, you know, I mean, I have to be really responsible to our restaurants and making sure that you know that I'm there to even only as a symbol of excellence.
And the current crunch, is that a big challenge for you?
Yeah, it's a challenge for everybody. Yeah,
you've made some changes in per se.
I think that we're forced to again look at what we do and try to you know, evolve. I think evolution is such an important part of who and what we are, regardless whether it's, you know, our evolution within our cuisine, our evolution within our restaurant, or in this case, you know, we have to evolve because of something that we've had no influence on. You know, I mean, it's not because of what we've done that have established this kind of environment for us. Nonetheless, we have to evolve, and I think what we want to try to do is give people the opportunity. to come to the restaurant. I mean, New York has been, you know, hit severely by the economic downturn, especially the financial market and financial industry. And, you know, we do have a large private dining room at Per Se.
Yeah.
And most of that private dining room was defined for that market. You know, 75% of our guests that were using our private dining room were in the financial industry. When that goes away, you have to start to think, okay, what do I need to do? How can I be responsible at the restaurant? How can I make sure that my cooks are staying, are cooking, my servers are working, everybody's in the restaurant still focused on maintaining the high quality? Because at some point, it'll shift back, and we need to be prepared. So we need to make sure that we're maintaining everything that we've built in our restaurants in preparation for that. In the meantime, we want to be able to offer to our guests an opportunity that they can still come to the restaurant. And because we understand and we're sympathetic and empathetic to the fact that we're all making less.
So an entry point without spending $900.
Right. Therefore, we want to make sure that the people can still enjoy it.
Yeah.
People can still maintain that sense of lifestyle that they had, you know, 2 years ago. And hopefully, you know, another year or whenever this financial market shifts, we'll be prepared again to offer our guests that same experience that we did before.
Okay, that's great. Were you talking to? Did they approach you to opening the casino here?
They did.
You weren't interested?
Well, it's, you know, you think about cooking, and cooking is about two things. I don't care what level you're doing, you know, and all from. It's about product and execution.
Yeah.
And you know, in the U.S., I've worked for 25 years to create the relationships with my suppliers.
Yeah.
And you come to my restaurant because you want to eat the food that tastes the way we make
and
it.
That's sort of the reverse and edge behind the French Laundry, wasn't
it?
Well,
yeah.
The
so, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I know the product here is amazing.
Yeah.
But how long would it take me to establish relationships with suppliers that are going to give me products that are unique? Mm. Because if I'm getting the same products as everybody else is getting, then the only part of the equation I have that's going to be different is the execution.
Yeah.
And therein lies the other challenge when you're going outside of your own country is actually getting staff that is going to be able to execute to the level that you want to execute. And it takes a long time. It's taken me 33 years to get to the point that I am today, working with the different teams that I have and establishing that understanding and the repertoire that we have. And then just to export that, you know, in 6 months or a year and a half, It's a scary idea.
Unless you've got the sort of structure of a Nobu, which is more sort of...
For fine dining, it would be very, very difficult.
Yeah,
I mean, you know,
exactly.
If you said casual dining or family dining, you know, it may be a little different thing.
Yeah.
You know, you can start to replicate that a little easier. But fine dining being, you know, again, this generation of chefs as opposed to the last generations of chefs, it's more of a personality cuisine. It's a very interpretive cuisine.
Yeah.
Last generation of chefs, you would go to, you know, the restaurants and everybody would have sole meunière, you know, on their menu. And what differentiated one from the other was the quality of the product that chef was able to get and his ability to execute it better.
Yeah.
I mean, at the end of the day, you know, all the great French chefs had the same repertoire and they were in the same classic dishes, what made it better? It was the execution and product. Today, it's more of the chef's personality.
Yeah.
You know, Daniel Boulud's cuisine, Pierre Gagné's cuisine, Thomas Keller's cuisine, Heston Blumenthal's cuisine. There's a foundation there that I think is a classic foundation for us all, but then we've all interpreted it in different ways.
You know, no one's articulated like that before. It's exactly right.
Yeah.
It's brilliant.
Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you.
Two friends last year who got